becomes, I will make you very fruitful. I will make nations of you. Genesis chapter 17, verse 6. Instead of the original paradise, with God present with his people, Israel is promised the land, and eventually given the temple as the place of God's presence. But the point is this. Israel, a small, strange, nomadic people in an obscure part of the world, is chosen to be the promise-bearer. Through your offspring, all nations on earth will be blessed. Genesis chapter 22, verse 18. Israel is to be a royal priesthood. Exodus chapter 19. Israel is to be the light of nations. Isaiah chapters 42 and 49. Israel is chosen out of the rest of the world in order to be God's strange means of rescuing the human race and so getting the creational project back on track. And God chooses Israel while knowing full well, in Paul's language, that Israel too is in Adam. The people who bear the solution are themselves part of the problem. That, in fact, is the clue to the hardest bits of Paul's theology. For instance, the problem of law. That's for another time. But watch closely. Israel is chosen to fulfill this divine purpose. Israel is placed in the Holy Land, the garden of God's delight, and Israel is warned that if they don't keep Torah, they will be expelled, sent off into exile. It will look as though the whole project has been aborted. That is the horrible problem faced not only in the exile, but in the so-called post-exilic period. And it is that complex problem that the New Testament sees being dealt with, gloriously resolved, in Israel's Messiah, Jesus the Lord, and his death and resurrection. He has dealt with exile, and now the whole world is God's holy land, with Jesus and his people as the light of the world. What might that tell us about the vocation of Adam, then? I do not know when Genesis reached its final form. Some still want to associate it with Moses. Others insist it was at least edited during the exile. But whatever view you take about that, certainly the Jews of the Second Temple period would have no difficulty in decoding the story of Adam as an earlier version of their own story. Placed in the garden, given a commission to look after it, being the place where God wanted to be at rest to exercise his sovereign rule, warned about keeping the commandment, warned in particular that breaking it would mean death, breaking it and being exiled. It all sounds very, very familiar, and it leads me to my proposal that just as God chose Israel from the rest of humankind for a special, strange, demanding vocation, so perhaps what Genesis is telling us is that God chose one pair from the rest of early hominids for a special, strange, demanding vocation. This pair, call them Adam and Eve if you like, were to be the representatives of the whole human race, the ones in whom God's purpose to make the whole world a place of delight and joy and order, eventually colonizing the whole creation, were to be taken forward. God the Creator put into their hands the fragile task of being his image-bearers. If they failed, they would bring the whole purpose for the wider creation, including all those other non-chosen hominids, down with them. They were supposed to be the life-bringers, and if they failed in their task, the death that was already endemic in the world as it was would engulf them as well. This, perhaps, is a way of understanding the warning of Genesis chapter 2. In the day you eat of it, you too will die. Not that death, the decay and dissolution of plants, animals, and hominids, wasn't a reality already, but you, Adam and Eve, are chosen to be the people through whom God's life-giving reflection will be imaged into the world. And if you choose to worship and serve the creation rather than the Creator, you will merely reflect death back to death, and will share that death yourself. I do not know whether this is exactly what Genesis meant or what Paul meant, but the close and, to a Jewish audience, rather obvious parallel between the vocation of Israel and the vocation of Adam leads me in that direction. And already, we should be able to see that the traditional Western picture of an Adam and Christ soteriological scheme presents a shrinkage of the original Pauline vision. One might perhaps sum up the problem like this. It isn't just that Adam sinned, and that Israel sinned as well. The problem is that Israel was called to be God's means of rescuing the world, but Israel was part of the Adamic problem to which it was supposed to be providing the solution. In a similar way, not exactly parallel but similar, Adam and Eve were chosen to take the Creator's purposes forward to a new dimension of life. But if they failed, if they abdicated their own image-bearing vocation, and followed the siren call of the elements of chaos still within creation, they would come to share the entropy that had so far been creation's lot. They did, and that's what happened. Christology and the project of new creation. All this, of course, projects us forward toward a full and rich Christology. This will not be simply about Jesus as both divine and human, that's a given, but it's only a shorthand, a signpost. Look at Paul's language. Jesus is the beginning, the first fruits, the true image, the temple in whom all God's fullness was pleased to dwell. He is Israel's Messiah, who fulfills Israel's obedience on the cross and thereby rescues both Israel and the whole human race. He does for Israel what Israel couldn't do for itself, and thereby does for humans what Israel was supposed to do for them, and thereby launches God's project of new creation, the new world over which he already reigns as king. This is the great narrative, the true Pauline Adam and Christ story, and we need to learn how to tell it and live it. Here we stumble upon an interesting possibility. The biologists and philosophers have pointed toward the complex notion of altruism as something that might just be a signpost away from the closed continuum of selfish genes. So too, in the Christian message, we have the cross, not just as an act of altruism. Altruism is, after all, a thin, bloodless word, a parody of the reality, but the supreme act of love. The Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me, wrote Paul, Galatians chapter 2, verse 20. Having loved his own, who were in the world, wrote John, he loved them to the end. John chapter 13, verse 1. The cross is, and Jesus always said it was, the subversion of all human power systems. The cross is the central thing that demonstrates the impossibility of the metaphysically inflated evolution with a capital E. The weakness of God is stronger than human strength, and it leads, and Jesus said it would lead, to a life of following him that would itself be about taking up the cross and so finding life, about the meek inheriting the earth. This is how the Adamic vocation is to be fulfilled. If we can study Genesis and human origins without hearing the call to be an image-bearing human being renewed in Jesus, we are massively missing the point. Perhaps pursuing our own dream of an otherworldly salvation that merely colludes with the forces of evil. That's what Gnosticism always does. Looking at Paul's picture of Adam from this point of view may be surprising to some, but it is not difficult to make oneself at home in it. This is the greatest story ever told, and it will draw all our stories up into it. Yes, many humans, though not all, are deeply aware of problems in their own lives, of pains and fears and sorrows and deep-rooted puzzles, and they may well bring them to the foot of the cross. But the message ought never to be simply about me and my salvation. It ought to be about God and God's kingdom. That's what Jesus announced, and so should we. The full good news is that in Jesus and through his death and resurrection, God has become King of the world. We look out at the world and see it in a terrible mess, and we are aware in our bones that we want to do something about it. But our own sin, our greed, our pride, our arrogance get in the way, and we rush off and try to do it in our own strength and, worse, our own way, like Moses trying to liberate Israel from Egypt by Egyptian means. He first needed liberating himself. We humans know in our bones that we are called to bring God's wise order into the world. That is our Adamic inheritance, just as much as the entail of evil. But for that to become a reality, we need ourselves to be rescued from the same problem that afflicts the rest of the world. We are rescued by the blood of the Lamb in order to be a royal priesthood. And the way in which that works, according to the New Testament, is the same way it worked for Jesus, taking up the cross, a suffering but joyful witness. That, too, is part of Paul's picture of the redeemed Adam. We suffer with him, that we may, in line, remember with Psalm 8, also share his glory. The distortions Western theology has introduced into Paul's Adam theology are cognate with the distortions, or the downright ignoring, that have happened in relation to the kingdom of God. They belong together, and together they may give us a sense of how to talk wisely both about salvation and about origins. Proposition 20. It is not essential that all people descended from Adam and Eve. This book has not been focusing on scientific issues because I am not a scientist, and those issues are complex. Instead, I have focused on what the biblical claims are regarding biological human origins, and in that regard, we have found no claims. At the same time, even very early interpreters undoubtedly considered Adam and Eve to be the progenitors of the entire human race. Evidence has been presented that Genesis chapter 2 talks about the nature of all people, not the unique, material origins of Adam and Eve. Consequently, we do not find human origins stories in Genesis chapter 2 that make scientific claims. That does not mean that modern scientific theories are therefore correct by default. It just means that we can consider scientific claims on their own merit, rather than dismissing them because they contradict biblical claims. Genetics. Scientific consensus regarding genetics is most strongly represented in the information that has been developed from the mapping of the human genome and comparing it to other genomes. At its most basic level, the genome shows a history through the presence of fusions, breaks, mutations, retroviruses, and pseudogenes. On this, no one disagrees. The disagreement arises when we question whether this history actually happened or whether God created people with a genome that looks like it has a history. This is similar to the age-old question of whether Adam had a belly button. If someone were to look at a dental X-ray of my mouth, they would see implants with titanium pegs, crowns, root canals, fillings, cracks in the enamel, etc. These would all stand as obvious evidence to a history, and in that way, the evidence in my mouth is comparable to the human genome. With the genome, however, the history is passed on from generation to generation, and can be compared with the genomes of other species. In such a comparison, remarkable similarities become evident that have indicated a material continuity between species, suggesting relatedness or similar histories. This is the understanding of common descent where genetic analysis provides evidence of a gradual development that would explain genetic diversity. The evidence for this shared history, uncovered by comparative genomics, is compelling and would be readily accepted were it not for the belief of some that, if such a history actually happened, it would contradict claims that are made in the Bible. Many who take the Bible seriously therefore insist that the history to which comparative genomics testifies, in fact, never happened. To substantiate the position that this genetic history never happened, it is necessary to contend that God, 1, created Adam de novo, distinct from any predecessors using no biological process, with a complicated genome. This genome would contain parts that do not function as they do in other species, mutations that disable genes, etc. Furthermore, the genome just happens to look a lot like the genomes of related species with most of the same genetic history evident in them, same flaws, in the same places. Or God, too, totally disrupted the genome, not only of humans but of all species, in very similar ways, as a response to the fall. If the Bible makes such claims that the evidence of history in the genome needs to be denied in one of these ways, so be it. That an act of God could bring about a product that has marks of a history that never actually occurred has been attested in Jesus turning the water into wine. In terms of probability, the resurrection looks highly unlikely, yet we affirm its reality. At the same time, denying de novo human origins would not be a case of denying a miracle that the Bible affirms if the Bible does not affirm it. So, before we dismiss the evidence of a genetic history provided by the genome, let's take a hard look at the biblical claims to decide what stand we need to take as those who take the Bible seriously. Two questions will be addressed in this chapter. 1. Does the Bible claim that Adam was the first human being ever to exist? 2. Does the Bible claim that all humans are descended from Adam and Eve? Current scientific understanding maintains that there was no first human being because humanity is the result of an evolving population. The evidence of genetics also points to the idea that the genetic diversity that exists in humanity today cannot be traced back to two individuals, a single pair, but that such diversity requires a genetic source population of thousands. If the Bible claims otherwise, then we would have to take a stand against this emerging scientific consensus. So far in this book, however, the analysis of the relationship of Genesis chapter 1 and chapter 2 has raised the possibility that the Adam and Eve account in Genesis chapter 2 could have come after an en masse creation of humanity in Genesis chapter 1. Though Adam and Eve should be considered as having been included in that group, Paul does not demand that Adam and Eve are the first or only humans. When he speaks of Adam as the first man, he is most interested in the archetypal role of Adam and in the theological issues surrounding sin. Finally, we should note that the two questions posed are not concerned with whether Adam and Eve are real people in a real past. I have already affirmed that I believe they are. If Genesis chapter 2 is not making claims about human origins, or demanding that Adam and Eve are the first or only humans, does it make such claims elsewhere? We are especially interested in whether the Bible is making claims about human origins that have scientific ramifications and could therefore stand in contradiction to the scientific consensus of today. Before we turn our attention to other biblical passages that have been thought to make claims about human origins, I want to note, briefly, some of the scientific conversations that are taking place that attempt to reconcile scientific conclusions and claims with biblical interpretation. Mitochondrial Eve and Y-chromosomal Adam. There has been much interest in conclusions drawn by scientists to the effect that there is a single female, dubbed mitochondrial Eve, from whom all current humans are descended. That is, she is the most recent common ancestor of all humans. Likewise, the Y chromosome that is found only in males can be tracked back to a single source. But we can't get too excited about this because the so-called mitochondrial Eve, an African woman who lived about 180,000 years ago, and Y chromosomal Adam, an African who is believed to have lived about 210,000 years ago, cannot be considered husband and wife. They are separated by 30,000 years. Furthermore, these two cannot succeed in lending support to the traditional Bible claims because to accept their existence means accepting many other premises of genetics that push in a different direction. For example, the way in which the genome shows a history and suggests continuity and common descent. For example, the same sort of information that identifies them shows that they are both members of large populations. While all humans today may share single ancestors such as mitochondrial Eve and Y-chromosomal Adam, they are not our only ancestors. I have no intention of arguing for or against the science. I only make the point that this information does not offer a way to integrate scientific findings with traditional biblical interpretation. Size of the genetic source population. Population geneticists generally claim that the evolved human population was never less than 5,000 to 10,000 individuals. They estimate that the smallest number occurred at a population bottleneck about 150,000 years ago. These numbers are derived from computer models, and arguments can be mounted that the models may not have all the parameters set precisely enough to generate full confidence. True as that may be, we should not delude ourselves into thinking that with more precise models, the number would go down to 2. Population genetics at this stage does not offer a path to reconciliation with traditional biblical interpretation. Adam and Eve among an initial population. In some models, Adam and Eve are thought of as 2 of the members of a small population of humans, and that through the course of time, as generation followed generation, their descendants spread through the population and other lines died out, such that by today everyone has genetic material from these 2. This view attempts to place Adam and Eve in Genesis chapter 1 among an en masse creation of humans and still retain the idea that Adam and Eve are the parents of us all. It affirms that Adam and Eve were among the first humans and that, through a complex process, we are all descended from Adam and Eve. Though it looks nothing like the traditional biblical interpretation, it makes similar affirmations while, at the same time, accommodating common descent and affirming that the history evident in the genome actually took place. These all maintain aspects of traditional biblical interpretation, while at the same time adopting some of the basic aspects of the current scientific consensus. They require selective acceptance of scientific findings and/or significantly adjusted biblical interpretation. We need to ask whether such complicated attempts at reconciliation are necessary, and so we return to the questions. Does the Bible claim that Adam is the first human being to exist and that all are descended from him? Does Acts chapter 17 verse 26 demand one man? Genesis chapter 2 has already been discussed at length, as has the reference to Adam as the first man in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. But the verse that many point to as the most persuasive on these issues is Acts chapter 17 verse 26. From one man he made all the nations. Nations of mankind, ethnos anthropon, that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. This is found in Paul's speech to the philosophers on Mars Hill concerning the unknown God. First, Paul presents the true God as non-contingent, Acts chapter 17, verse 24, made the world and everything in it, as transcendent, Acts chapter 17, verse 24, does not live in temples built by human hands, as not operating in the great symbiosis, Acts chapter 17, verse 25, has no needs, and as one on whom all people as his creatures are contingent, Acts chapter 17, verse 25, gives everyone life and breath and everything else. These statements all pertain to God's role as creator. In Acts chapter 17, verse 26, Paul's rhetoric transitions to a geopolitical, historical, and societal focus. He indicates that nations, historical roles, and territories are all dependent on God. I would contend that, in this verse, he is not talking about biology or about human origins. He is discussing national origins. God's making, poiau, of a nation is not a material act, but an organizational one. We may well ask how and where in Scripture God makes the nations. The nations come into being through lines of descendants, and the Bible communicates that process very explicitly in Genesis chapter 10, the so-called Table of Nations. There the lines of Noah's three sons are traced as a means of identifying the lineage of the 70 known countries and peoples in the author's time. Genesis chapter 10 verse 32 concludes that from these three sons of Noah come all the nations. These are the clans of Noah's sons according to their lines of descent within their nations. From these nations, ethnon, spread out over the earth after the flood. This is the only verse in the Old Testament that talks about the origins of the nations as a group, and is therefore arguably the verse to which Paul refers. If that is so, the one that he refers to is Noah, not Adam. If human origins were the point, we might expect Paul to use the basic anthropon rather than making the nations the focus. Furthermore, the concept of national identity fits better in this verse in connection with historical periods and territorial boundaries. Finally, he brackets this part of the speech with the conclusion, "We are his offspring." End of Acts chapter 17, verse 28, which parallels the beginning of Acts chapter 17, verse 26, "From one man he made." Between this and the focus on geopolitical entities, we can rightly question whether Paul was making a statement about material, biological origins. Was he making a claim that argues against a wider range of genetic sources for humanity, polygenism? That would be a dubious conclusion. Paul, of course, knew nothing about genetics. He is instead pointing to the remarkable work of God's formation of multiple national identities from the three sons of Noah. Mother of all living. Genesis chapter 3, verse 20 is another verse from which some interpreters inferred a biblical claim that all humans trace their genetic heritage back to Adam and Eve. Here, Adam gives his wife the name Eve. Hebrew, Chava, equals life, indicating that she was the mother of all the living. Does this constitute a biblical claim that all humans are genetically descended from Eve? Several observations militate against that conclusion. First, the reference to the living in the explanation of her name is a word that can refer to all creatures. Yet all animals are not biological descendants of Eve. Second, the expression, mother of all, is not necessarily one that pertains to biology. Notice that in Genesis chapter 4, verse 20, Jabal was the father of those who live in tents and raise livestock. In Genesis chapter 4, verse 21, Jubal was the father of all who play stringed instruments and pipes. These usages show that this sort of expression has larger associations in mind than just biological descent. Genealogies. Another argument from the biblical text is that the genealogies consistently go back to Adam. Genesis chapter 5, 1 Chronicles chapter 1, Luke chapter 3 verse 38, suggesting that he is the first human being. It would not be surprising if Israelites in Old Testament and New Testament times believed that Adam was the first human. The hermeneutical issue, however, is more subtle. Were they teaching that Adam was the first human being? Were they building theology on that concept? Or is God simply using their contemporary concepts as a framework for communication? We have already used the examples of physiology and cosmic geography as examples of God using familiar ideas of the time rather than updating science. We noted that there is no new revelation in the Bible concurring the regular operations of the natural world. The allusion to physiology, for example, does not constitute revelation about physiology or a divine endorsement of a particular physiology. We could make the same claim with regard to genealogy. Adam is the first significant person in their realm of knowledge, and he is indeed historically and theologically significant, and they drive all significant connections back to him. In Genesis, the genealogy offers the line from Adam, however he fits in, to Noah. In 1 Chronicles, the concern is about Jewish identity as the representatives of the kingdom of God. It is natural that Adam be viewed as the fountainhead of the people of God. That role does not depend on particular views of genetic ancestry or material continuity. His federal headship would easily serve as an appropriate basis for the genealogy to go back to him. The genealogy in Luke 3 traces the lineage of Jesus back through genealogies to establish his place in history. It does not just go back to Adam, it goes back to God. This is a lineage through Joseph, so it is specifically not his biological lineage. Adam is the first significant human, and the connection to God because of the very particular role that he had. Again, federal headship gives an adequate connection, as does his priestly role. In all these cases, while the Bible could be interpreted as suggesting that Adam was the first human being, it is more debatable whether it is making a scientific claim that would controvert the possibility that modern humanity is descended from a pool of common ancestors, as indicated by the genetic evidence. I would then conclude that any contention that the Bible is making a claim that Adam is the first human being, or that all humans are descended from him, is debatable. Proposition 21. Humans could be viewed as distinct creatures and a special creation of God, even if there was material continuity. In the last chapter, we discussed Adam and Eve's relationship to all of us who have come after them. In this chapter, we will begin by turning our attention to their relationship to what came before them. The modern scientific consensus affirms that there is material continuity between all species of life, technically designated phylogenetic continuity. Evolutionary models offer an explanation of how this gradual change over time from a common ancestor took place. It is one thing to believe that all species have a common ancestor, and it is quite another to explain what mechanisms drove the process of change. The former idea is almost universally affirmed among scientists. The latter is still under vigorous debate. The fossil record, comparative anatomy, and the genome likewise all point to common descent, but they offer no information about what factors drove the change. In one sense, all of these offer snapshots at various stages, whereas evolutionary models attempt, in effect, to incorporate those snapshots into a video. Consequently, one could theoretically accept the concepts of phylogenetic continuity and common descent based on the information from comparative genomics or the fossil record, yet be very skeptical of the current mechanisms proposed by evolutionary models. For example, mutation, natural selection. Evolution can be defined as an interpretation of the world around us that posits a material, phylogenetic, continuity among all species of creatures, biological and genetic, not spiritual, as the result of a process of change over time through various mechanisms, known and unknown. It is not inherently atheistic or deistic. It has plenty of room for the providence of God, as well as the intimate involvement of God. It is beyond the scope of this book to discuss whether evolutionary models are correct or not. The more important question is whether the conclusions of common descent and material continuity are compatible with a faithful interpretation of the Bible. Today, many of those who are proponents of evolutionary models see those models as an alternative to the involvement of a creator God, and some insist that such models show that the need for a creator God is obsolete. Obviously, such conclusions cannot be accepted by Christians. Other scientists, however, accept the concept of common descent and even some evolutionary models, but view God as one who is creating through a process that features change over time from a common ancestor. This approach is known as evolutionary creation. Therefore, to consider change over time, common descent, material continuity, or even an evolutionary model, is not a decision that automatically rules God out of the picture. These do not necessitate the conclusion that there is no God, or that he was not active in creation. God can be viewed as creator, even in the context of such scientific conclusions. At the same time, we would have to readily acknowledge that nothing in the biblical text suggests such an understanding of human origins. Since Genesis is an ancient document, we would not expect it to address these modern ideas. Nevertheless, we need to ask whether information based on the authoritative teaching of Scripture rules out such a possibility. Could someone who takes the Bible seriously believe in common descent and material continuity? The easiest, casual interpretation of the text, and one that has been believed for millennia, or one that did not have access to ancient Near Eastern texts, would suggest a de novo creation of human beings. In a fully de novo view, there is material continuity. No human or other primate predecessors with whom humans shared a common ancestor. In this view, God is directly involved in the special creation of Adam and Eve, distinct from other creatures and not derived from them in any material way. That remains a very plausible interpretation, but, again we ask, is such a view the actual claim of Scripture with the weight of authority behind it, such that failure to understand it this way constitutes rejection of biblical truths? In previous chapters, I have offered what I believe to be a faithful interpretation of the authoritative claims of Scripture in its own literary, theological, and cultural context that suggests that the Bible does not need to be understood as affirming a de novo view. Instead, I have suggested that the Bible does not really offer any information about material human origins. This would mean that the scientific claims of common descent and material continuity would not be automatically ruled out. It is important, nevertheless, to realize that the adoption of common descent and material continuity does not eliminate the idea that human beings are created by God and are uniquely spiritual beings who possess the image of God. The image of God is not neurological and not materially defined in terms of neuroscience or genetics. It has no material component, though the image is embodied. Human distinctiveness is spiritual. We can discuss spiritual uniqueness in three basic categories. First, based on the discussion in chapter 12, we can see that Adam and Eve are distinguished from any other humans that may have existed in their time by having been designated as priests serving representatively in sacred space. This is presented as a role given to them by God, a role that is spiritual in nature. Note that in similar ways, Abraham is not materially distinct from any others of his time, but he is selected by God and assigned a spiritual role. Second, is the Christian belief that humans have a spiritual nature of some sort. There is still much discussion, and perhaps even increasing disagreement, over how that spiritual part of us needs to be described and understood. But we believe that we are more than biological specimens. We are more than carbon-based life forms. Neuroscience can provide explanations about how we came to realize that we are more than biological specimens, but not how we came to be more. Whether we call this the soul or spirit, or whether we are dualists or monists, or something else, as Christians we believe that there is some part of us, in fact, the most important part of us, that survives the death of the body. This is not something that can evolve. It is not possessed by those other creatures in a line of common descent. It represents a spiritual discontinuity, even if one concludes that there is material continuity. It is granted by God, we don't know how or when, as a direct, special creative act of God, and it differentiates us from every other creature. The third aspect of our human spiritual uniqueness is found in the image of God that we have been given. The image of God is not the same thing as our spiritual nature, but like our spiritual nature, it is not something that just develops in the human species over time. One of the most common ways to define the image of God is to start with the proposition that the image of God distinguishes us from all creatures. And with this, I would agree. I would, however, disagree with then drawing the conclusion that anything that distinguishes us from other creatures tells us what the image of God is. Fortunately, such theories focus on mental capacities rather than the presence of opposable thumbs. Even so, the image of God must be seen as more than the sum total of capacities whose developments can be traced by neuroscience. The image of God is, by definition, who we are as human beings. It is not the mark of humanity. It is how humans are marked. It is not what makes us human, but, as humans, we have the image of God. I believe that the image of God is something that is a direct, spiritually defined gift of God to humans. For those who believe that humans are biologically a product of change over time through common descent, the image of God would be given by God to humans at a particular time in that history. It would not be detectable in the fossil record or in the genome. So now we must take a closer look at what the image of God is. The image of God. The image of God has been the topic of numerous dissertations and monographs in a variety of disciplines. For example, exegetical treatments of Genesis, theology, philosophy, art history, neuroscience/psychology. So this treatment will be embarrassingly brief. I have only space enough to survey the aspects of the image of God that these studies, as well as my own, have identified. This will entail a brief presentation of four aspects: function, identity, substitution, and relationship. These are not mutually exclusive alternatives, and I would propose that each of them is true. Function. The understanding of the image of God as an assigned role with an inherent function has long been part of the discussion. Most recently, it has been championed by J. Richard Middleton. In this view, Humanity corporately functions as God's vice-regents, stewards who are charged with subduing and ruling as articulated in the very context in which the image is granted. Genesis chapter 1 verses 26 to 30. As a corporate designation, it differentiates humanity from all other creatures and species. Those capacities that can be discussed neurologically, self-awareness, God-awareness, etc., may well be understood as allowing us to carry out this task, but they would not themselves define the image of God. All humans have a role to play in this aspect of our corporate identity, regardless of how well they function mentally or physically. Identity. This aspect of the image of God expresses our core identity. This is who we are. We should recall that naming is an act of creation in the ancient Near East. It then follows that when God designates humankind as His image, this is what humankind becomes. The image becomes interwoven in our destiny and our nature. Like any name in the Old Testament, it takes on reality over time in any number of possible ways. This identity is assigned by our Creator. It is not something we could take on our own for ourselves, and it is not something that can just develop in us. Just as naming is an act of creation in the ancient world, so this giving of identity is a spiritual act of special creation. Substitution. When a king in the ancient world had an image of himself placed by the gate in a city he had conquered, or at the border of a land that he claimed, the image proclaimed the king's presence there. It was a substitute, but it was more than just a stand-in. In its aesthetics, it communicated important ideas about the king and about kingship. The images of the gods in the temples did the same on a larger scale because the images of the gods had been inaugurated by a ritual that endowed the image with the divine essence. In this way, the material nature and existence of the image faded almost into non-significance, though the very best materials had been used. It had become a fit repository for the divine essence, and that was the most important thing about it. The image did not just contain the divine essence, it was transformed into something spiritual in nature. It is interesting that in Genesis, God's image, humanity, is crafted from the very meanest of materials, thus emphasizing in contrast the proportionally heightened value of the divine image. Yet, as in the case of images in the ancient world, we, as His image, stand in as God's substitutes. We represent His presence in sacred space. His essence makes us spiritual beings and constitutes discontinuity from any other creature. Just as images were revered as divine creations in the ancient world, we are considered to be the works of God in the truest possible sense. Divine-human relationship. In each of the previous categories, the premise of the category implied some level of relationship between God and His people. In this last category, more specificity can be provided to suggest that the relationship is best expressed in filial terms. In the biblical text, this can be most easily observed when Adam begets Seth, in his own likeness, in his own image, in Genesis chapter 5, verses 1 to 3. This same idea can be identified in the ancient Near East, where the image is considered to be born in heaven, even though it is made on earth. Summary of image. The image of God provides yet another piece of evidence from the biblical text concerning the spiritual discontinuity that is characteristic of humans in contradistinction to other creatures. The four categories for understanding the image of God presented are not mutually exclusive. All four can be accepted as each gives insight into the descriptor. When we consider the image in these four categories, we can affirm that all human beings must be considered as participating in the divine image. It is something that is more corporate than individual. Furthermore, it is clear from the occurrences throughout the biblical text that the image was not lost when Adam and Eve were sent from the garden, though it was marred. The functions that were entrusted to us in Genesis chapter 1 are still our responsibilities, though our ability to carry out those functions may be hampered in a variety of ways by our current condition. Even as we have seen many points of contact between Genesis and the ancient Near East, we should not neglect to notice the places where the Israelites were departing from the standard ways of thinking in the ancient world. People, God's images, were placed in sacred space, just as the images of the Babylonian gods were placed in sacred space in their temples to mediate God's presence and God's revelation. But images were excluded in worship in Israel. We are the only images God allows. Conclusion. In this chapter, we have not proffered a conclusion regarding material continuity. Instead, we have observed that comparative genomics indicates that there is a history, so we have to decide whether the Bible claims that such a history never took place because God created humans de novo. To the extent that we become aware of viable interpretations of the biblical text that do not require de novo, we can consider other options for understanding God's creation of humans. Not only can we see that God the Creator is in any of these models, we can also recognize that there are numerous points of spiritual discontinuity where we recognize special creative work of God that cannot be explained by any understanding of natural change over time or identified in the human genome, even if there is a higher level of material continuity than traditionally accepted. Humans are the special, direct creation of God in certain ways. That is not in question. The uncertainty lies in how much of that special creation falls into the material category. Conclusion and summary. In the preceding chapters, we have examined the biblical claims concerning Adam and Eve, the garden, the serpent, and the fall. Our investigation has focused on the text of Genesis as an ancient Near Eastern document. We have been particularly interested in determining the extent to which the biblical claims may or may not conflict with the claims made in the current scientific consensus about human origins. We have studiously avoided imposing scientific or ancient Near Eastern claims on the Bible. Instead, we have sought to assess the biblical claims independently, and only then to compare to what we find in other ancient Near Eastern literature and to the evidence suggested by scientific findings. We expect Genesis to be characterized in part by perspectives that are found in the literature of the ancient Near East because God was communicating into an ancient Near Eastern culture, ancient Israel. We also expect Genesis, interpreted properly, to be compatible with the truths about our world that scientists uncover because both the world and the Word emanate from God. The first several chapters of this book summarized the interpretation I have previously offered of Genesis chapter 1. These focused on the idea that the origins story that Genesis chapter 1 tells has more to do with order, functions, and roles than with the material cosmos. The order that God established inaugurated sacred space in the cosmos. God intended to enter into the place that He had prepared for people in His image and to be in relationship with them there. Genesis chapter 2 then tells of the establishment of a terrestrial center of sacred space in what is identified as a garden, where Adam and Eve are commissioned as priests to serve in sacred space, mediating revelation of God and access to God. Adam and Eve are presented as archetypes in their formation. They embody all people, and the affirmations of the forming accounts are affirmations made of everyone, not uniquely of them. All humans are made of dust. Womankind is from the side of mankind. Adam and Eve are also established as priestly representatives through whom life and wisdom can be achieved as people are drawn into relationship with God. Unfortunately, they failed to achieve these benefits because they opted to position themselves as the center of order, and in so doing, becoming like God, in place of God. A number of these elements in Genesis find similarities with ancient Near Eastern literature, while others are entirely unique in the ancient world. Proper interpretation will recognize both. We should note, however, that the Israelites often show marked dissimilarity from the surrounding cultures, even when they share concepts with the ancient world. So, for example, even though ancient Near Eastern literature considers the creation of humanity to involve a large group of humans, the underlying reasons are far different from what would exist in the biblical text if en masse creation of humanity were to be seen from Genesis chapter 1. In the ancient Near East creation narratives, many humans are created at once because many gods were intending to use many humans to supply their needs. The purposes of gods would not be well served if only a few humans were created. In contrast, if Genesis chapter 1 allows en masse creation of humans, as I have argued, it is not for the same reason. The God of the Bible has no needs, and the function of humans is presented in very different terms. Likewise, the roles and functions of human beings as presented in the Bible cannot be confirmed through science, because science is incapable of discussing final causes. When we shift our attention to the archetypal roles, the fact that ancient Near Eastern texts also feature an archetypal view of human origins helps us to recognize that this way of thinking would not be unusual for Israelites in their cultural context. At the same time, we find that the message to be found in the archetypal presentation in Genesis is of a totally different sort from what is found in the ancient Near East. The messages associated with the archetypal representation in Genesis are as follows. Humankind was created with mortal bodies. Humankind was provisioned by God, garden. Humankind was given the role of serving in sacred space, implies relationship with God. Humankind was divided into male and female, and so would seek out new family relationship. These points constitute the main teaching of Genesis chapter 2. They convey important ideas about the nature of God, the nature of humanity, and both horizontal and vertical relationships. Once the forming accounts are recognized as archetypal, they cease to be meaningful in terms of chronology or history of material human origins, even given my continued assertion that Adam and Eve are historical persons. If the accounts of their forming are archetypal in nature rather than material, those forming accounts are important not as events of material creation, but as ideas about the nature of humanity. Nevertheless, I have identified in the text evidences that the Israelites, as well as the New Testament authors, believed Adam and Eve to be real people who lived in a real past. The question to be asked, however, is whether this belief is simply cultural and therefore not binding. The hermeneutical principle that I use to make that determination is whether the text hangs theology on the belief. For example, in the ancient world they believed that the heart was the center of intellect and emotion, and the text affirms that belief. But no theology is built on it in the biblical text. Therefore, once that is recognized as simply a cultural way of thinking in the ancient world, rather than the inspired, authoritative revelation of God, I can safely set aside that belief. The question, then, is whether theological teachings are derived from the historicity of Adam and Eve. On this question, we can draw a distinction between the theology connected to the doctrine of Scripture and that connected to other doctrines. For example, sin. If we simply say that inerrancy demands that we accept a historical Adam because he is mentioned in the genealogies, we are failing to distinguish